Couple of months ago, we had a guest speaker, Lupe Gonzalez, who brought a sermonette entitled In the Footsteps of Ruth. And he went through the book of Ruth and explained the story of what was going on there. And so this last week, I had an opportunity to drive from here over to Harrison, Arkansas, and back. And there were And something I don't normally see in this area was a ripe winter wheat field that was being harvested. Combines were out there, and they were just hauling big trucks. They were harvesting the grain and hauling it off. And this wheat was obviously planted in the fall. They call it winter wheat. It sprouted, and it grew early this spring and was done there. And I thought back to that time. It's a harvest time in the book of Ruth. And of course, if we took a look at why there was a book of Ruth, and we've recently covered the story about the five women in the book of Matthew who are in the genealogy of Christ. And if we look through Matthew 1 and we read that, and we read about Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba and then on to Mary, and we read about those, but there is someone who is not listed there who is integral to the story, to this entire scenario. So we have those the five women, and we can't help but wonder why those five women are there when others were not listed. And there are so many other good ones that could have been in there. But of course, as we reviewed in the recent message, you know, that, well, under ordinary circumstances, they wouldn't have been there. There was something that was unusual that caused them to be there. Well, just as we recently heard about the message from Mr. Gonzalez about In the Footsteps of Ruth, today I want to talk about In the Footsteps of Naomi, which would be Ruth's mother-in-law. It was just here a month ago that we had Pentecost, and the theory is that God delivered the tables of stone engraved on the Ten Commandments, and then delivered them to Moses on Mount Sinai, presumably on the day of Pentecost. And it's a long-standing tradition that Hebrew tradition that the Book of Ruth then was read on Pentecost just 1 month ago. And it's a delightful story, a story of happiness and sadness, of hunger and plenty, of life and death, sadness and joy, and of romance and heartache, and of a challenged inheritance, and ultimately ending with hope and opportunity. So it was really an interesting book, and it tells us a lot, and if we go over that. But we take a look at this woman, Ruth, a stranger from a foreign land who was transplanted back into the nation of Israel, and she represents the hope of people who have an opportunity to be in God's family, really representing God's mercy to calling us to be involved in his work, to be brought into the kingdom of God. But I want to focus then on her mother-in-law, this woman in the book of Ruth, a woman named Naomi. For the story of Naomi is woven into the story of Ruth, but it's a very different story. Naomi was an important mother in the history of Israel, and when we examine this particular story, we'll gain a remarkable understanding of the father of a man called Boaz. And when we move on to this through this example, we'll see how Naomi is really an example for us today. If we start in Book of Ruth in chapter 1 and verse 1, and it tells us that there was a famine in the land. It was in the day of Judges. And a man from Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab. Now, it's about 40 miles away. So if we were to get on, start walking, just figure out about 40 miles, how far would that be? And it would take a while. And if you walk 2 miles an hour, it would take what? How many hours to get there? Because presumably you wouldn't be carrying, you'd be bringing burdens along with you, maybe a beast of burden. Verse 2, the man was Elimelech. Okay, he went to this neighboring country. There was a famine in Bethlehem, Judah. Elimelech went with his wife, Naomi, and two sons, and they stayed there. So they when you got to eat, you got to eat. It gets pretty important. They say that after 72 hours, everybody will do almost anything to get a bite to eat. And so they were motivated. So the time setting is a generation after Israel had come into the Promised Land, when they had left Egypt, conquered, then 40 years later, conquered Jericho, claimed the land of Canaan, and inherited the land, and the land was divided among 12 tribes. And that's why there's a reference to Bethlehem in Judah. It refers to the town of Bethlehem in an area of land that was granted to the tribe of Judah. Now, the man Elimelech, referred to in Ruth chapter 1, may be that he was a brother to Salmon, the Israelite who married Rahab, the innkeeper's daughter, who hid the Israelite spies when they scouted out Jericho prior to the fall of Jericho. We don't know the exact relationship, but we do know that Naomi was Elimelech's wife. They were Israelites. They were of the tribe of Judah. And so when the famine came up, nothing to eat, Naomi went with her husband to Moab. Now, it's on the other side of the Jordan River, so they had a ways to go. But presumably, if there's a famine, then they can cross the river a little easier, too. The Moabites were a nearby land, but they were also descendants of Lot, Abraham's nephew. But the Moabites didn't worship the true God. They were a foreign nation, and so there was an issue there. Would you go to a place that didn't worship the true God and try to make your life there? Well, things got worse. If we look in verse 3, in Ruth 1, verse 3, then Elimelech died. Naomi's husband died and left her there. Now, she was a widow and her two sons. Now, we have to ask, well, now Naomi is stranded in a foreign land. She's lost her husband. And it wasn't so far in physical distance, but it was far away from the fellowship and believers in God. And they weren't simply strangers in a foreign land, but the strangers were worshiping other gods. I know that when I have moved in my life a few times, it was kind of important to me to know how far I was to the nearest church congregation. I didn't want to be stranded off in the wilderness somewhere. So it's always been a factor of just where would I be? Could I get to that place? Now, I was raised in South Central Minnesota, about equidistant from Iowa, Wisconsin, and South Dakota. If you measured it out on the map, it'd be about equidistant from all of those three places. And my great-grandfather homesteaded the area, went by ox cart and built a prairie home and staked their claim, dug a sod hut, and then later built and planted potatoes and wheat. Later they built a log cabin and later on a frame house. And people came and expanded into that area, and they built neighborhood one-room schoolhouses. I went to that one that my great-grandfather helped build. One-room country schoolhouse. My grandfather went to it, and a rural community was developed. About every 4 or 5 miles, you'd have another little rural community. So by the time I came along, families were all well-established, and everybody knew, because the same farms were in the same family for many years. Well, everybody knew the farms in the area by the family name, and you knew who was new in town. Because, whoa, so-and-so up the road had a particular, you know, they came into town and they were renting the Otto farm or the Rettman farm, or, hey, that's the Platt farm or the Schmidt farm, all of these German names. So if somebody else came in, oh, where do they live? Well, they live over, and there was a new family came in a half a mile away, the Benson family. Doesn't sound German, does it? But they came in and they bought the Bunky farm. Oh, well, everybody referred to it for the next generation as the Bunky Farm. So everybody knew who the strangers were, even though they could have been there for 20, 25, 30 years. It was still going to be the Bunky Farm, Even today, we'll refer to that now, 50, 60 years later, as the Bunkie Farm. But now people are grudgingly calling it the Benson Place after they're getting used to it. So I imagine it's like that in Moab, too. They know who the strangers were. They know who the new kids on the block are and so forth. They were strangers because they weren't born there. So I can imagine that's the way it worked in Moab as well. But if we look in Ruth 1 and verse 4, and the sons of Elimelech and Naomi took wives, local gals, they got married, of the women of Moab. One was Orpah, the other was Ruth, and they dwelt there about 10 years. So I'm not exactly sure when the 10 years started, but we know that Naomi was gone from Bethlehem, Judah for a long time. Now, and the sons didn't go back. They didn't go 30, 40 miles back to get wives from their homeland or the tribe. They married the local gals, which is not uncommon to marry the people that are in your neighborhood back when your feet were the primary method of getting around. I know that when my family was homesteading in the area, there were six Martins, three boys and three girls, and three of those siblings married three siblings from another family, a Platt family. So you had two Martins boys and a Martins girl married, two of the Platt girls and one of the Platt boys. Why? Because they were the neighbors. They had known each other. They were 3 miles apart. That's who they knew at the local school. So they married people that they knew. And of course, that produced three sets of double cousins. I remember as a kid sitting at my grandparents' table, and I realized that those were my grandfather's cousins also sitting at the table, that all three were cousins to each other, but they all had, and their parents were as at the same gene pool, all one set of grandparents there. And I'm going, this is what I'm going to look like when I'm 70 years old. I now twitch a little bit when I see their pictures, and now that I'm now that I can see myself for those what they call double cousins. So you can see the people in that neighborhood that grew up that way. And the sons, but married the local gals. Now, I don't suppose that Elimelech and Naomi thought about that ahead of time. They didn't make other plans, but Elimelech did die and left Naomi with the two boys. In Deuteronomy 7, in verse 7, in Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 7, the instruction was, is when you go into the land, don't make covenants with them, don't make agreements, and don't make marriages. In verse 3, don't make marriages with them. Don't give your daughter or son to them, or take their daughter for your son. For they'll turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Well, this is a kind of an important principle. You don't want to be taken away from the truths of God by a potential mate. And so they said, don't marry outside the nation of Israel. That would pull them away. And indeed, that's happened again and again as we read through the Bible. So we read that this is a caution. But so when we read the story of Ruth, and with Naomi's husband Elimelech dead, the sons didn't have their father to arrange a marriage for them. So otherwise, the father would have been able to arrange marriages. In fact, that was pretty common, where the parents arranged marriages for their children. In fact, indeed, it's common in many places around the world today. Not the Western world, not in America, but it is in many parts of the world that marriages are arranged. So it didn't happen then, so they took local gals to be their wives. And if we take a look then in an odd circumstance in Ruth 1, in verse 5, both of the sons died. Well, now we have Naomi as a widow, and her two daughters-in-law became widows. Now you have three widows, and now this is a really awkward situation. And of course, if we look back on Deuteronomy 7 and verse 4 that we just read, the implication is that both sons died suddenly. They did what they shouldn't have done. They didn't have God's protection. In any event, they died. So now you have this tragedy piled upon tragedy for Naomi, because now she was bereft of even her sons in a strange land. There's no Social Security check that's going to come her way each month. No survivor's benefits from a life insurance policy. No relatives to look after her. Naomi was in a predicament. So what do we read in Ruth in chapter 1, and verse starting in verse 6? So she arose with her daughters-in-law. In other words, they were apparently in close contact, and that she might return from the country of Moab, for she heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people, meaning back in Judah, and given them bread. Therefore, she went out from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on their way to return to the land of Judah. You see, Naomi was making the best decision she could under the circumstances, and she knew that she would receive at least some care among her relatives back in Bethlehem, among the people whom she knew and would be accepted. And she recognized that unless she left Moab, she was otherwise stuck in a foreign land among strangers that worshiped foreign gods. Now, if we imagine ourselves and we're off somewhere and all of a sudden we're bereft of people that we know without a means of support in a strange place, it would be very awkward. So what does Naomi say to her daughters-in-law in Ruth 1, verse 8? Naomi says to her two daughters-in-law, go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you've dealt with the dead and with me, meaning her husband and her mother-in-law. The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband. So she kissed them and lifted up their voices and wept. See, all three women were crying. This was goodbye. This was it. They knew they would never see each other again. There wasn't a telephone. There was no fax machine. There was no postal service, no internet, no cell phone, no Pony Express messenger service, no planes, trains, or automobiles to take them back and forth for visits. The goodbyes would be permanent, sort of like when the Wild West was expanded from the East Coast, when an American in the middle to late 1800s, people would go by wagon train across the country. When you said goodbye, that was it. You didn't have any expectation that you would see them again. So in the case of Ruth and Orpah, when in verse 8, when Naomi said, go back to your mother's house, it's possible that their fathers were also dead, because it didn't say go back to your father's house, because normally they would go back to their father's house under those circumstances. But as the custom was, the mothers were now under the care and responsibility of her sons, which would be Orpah's and Ruth's brothers. And Ruth, chapter 1 of verse 10, they said, well, sure, we're going to go with you. Let's go. You know, they apparently got along well with their mother-in-law. And what did Naomi say? Look, go back. Why would you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Because you see, if Naomi had other sons under the law, community law at that time, they would have been entitled to marry the widow of the brother. But she says, I don't have any more sons. I'm not going to birth any more sons. This is not going to happen. Let's face reality. she said, I'm too old for a husband. And even if I should, have a son tonight, it's still, are you going to wait around until the son is grown? Of course, that would have to be 20 years. Well, we know that these gals are probably in their 20s. And so are they going to wait around 20 years for a toddler to grow up to be a future husband? And then, of course, there's two of them. So it just didn't make any sense. And Naomi knew that. And in verse 13, she said, would you restrain yourself from having husbands? Are you going to wait that long? All that time. She goes, no, my daughters, it's very grievous for me for your sake, and the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. In other words, don't take my burden against you. So go back to your mother's house, meaning where your mother's sons can watch over you. So what we're looking at is the Levirate law of marriage that Naomi was referring to in Deuteronomy 25 and verse 5, and I'll just paraphrase it. And it talks about if brothers who dwell together and one died and didn't have sons, then the next brother would be obligated to marry the widow and raise up a son for inheritance purposes of the older brother. And so that's, and that was an expectation. Indeed, there are examples of that. And that happened in my family as well, when my my grandmother's husband died, and the and they had two little kids. She was a 23-year-old widow, had a little girl, had a little boy, and it was a result from a slight farm accident, and that little boy was my dad, and his father was. You know, just a small break in the skin, but he got blood poisoning and he was dead in 3 days from sepsis. Boom, left a young widow. My dad's first steps at 10 months of age were on the day his dad was buried. Well, this is a problem because now you have two brothers that were farming together, a married brother and a bachelor brother. But the farm was jointly owned and there was no will, there was no disposition. So what are they going to do? And my great-grandfather dearly loved my grandmother, his daughter-in-law, and he explained the law and said, the bachelor brother owns half of the whole farm, and the widow doesn't get the other half because there's no will. The widow gets a quarter, and each of the kids get an eighth. So he said, the thing to do, and it's a scandal. You've got a single brother living upstairs and a widowed living downstairs with two little kids. He said, the only way you're going to solve this problem is you need to marry the farm back together again, because that was a cultural expectation. And they did. I didn't know this till I was a teenager. So Grandpa was actually my grandfather's brother. Same name. Everybody looked like family, all the same relatives. Surprise, surprise, surprise. When I'm here 13 or 14 and I'm finding all this out, reaching the age of awareness. So the expectation was there was a reason for marrying back together. And of course, my grandpa, a really great uncle, and my grandmother went on to have another son. And I only caught strange remarks about this from a neighbor, old neighbors, who says, oh, it's just a marriage of convenience. I had no idea what they were talking about. So I can see that these sorts of things have happened around the world for a long time. But now you have the relationship between Naomi and her daughters-in-law. Now, I don't know if any of you collect mother-in-law jokes. Some people do. I don't. But I'm aware that they're out there. Okay. My mother-in-law did not give me a lot of grief, for which I appreciate. And I don't think my mom gave my wife a lot of grief either. It was just beneficial relationships. Now, we do have a daughter in Japan, and of course she's conversant in Japanese, and she explained the writing in Japanese. The word for peace is a pictogram of a house with one woman in it. And the word for war is the exact same little house, but it's got two women in it. Now, you know words. This was just the explanation. You have peace, and then you have war. So we all got a chuckle when she was explaining to us this. In Ruth 1, in verse 15, Naomi said, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. So we have now, Orpah is going back to her family, and Naomi tells Ruth, you know, go ahead, go back. You know, it's I understand, you know, I want you to be cared for. And in verse 16, Ruth says, don't tell me this. I don't want to leave you. And then she makes this marvelous statement. I don't want to turn back from following you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you judge, I will judge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do to me, so do to me and more. Also, if anything but death parts you and me. This is really the model of commitment that we make to God when we're converted and are baptized. We make this same pledge of faithfulness to God as modeled by Ruth's commitment to Naomi. And Ruth, chapter 1 and verse 18, when she, meaning Naomi, saw that she was determined to go with her, she stopped speaking to her. In other words, quit trying to convince her. You know, it was useless because Ruth was committed. And this is the lesson that's often emphasized at the Feast of Pentecost, that we're to welcome those who choose to obey God, who want to follow God and bring God's ways into their life. And so in verse 18, Naomi quit trying to convince Ruth to go behind or go back to Moab. But Ruth was determined to follow Naomi. And we read in verse 19, Ruth 1:19, now the two of them, Ruth and Naomi, went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, all the city was excited of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? Well, it had to be quite a stir. Now, we know it's more than 10 years. Okay, so that much we know. Isn't that the way it is sometimes? Somebody you haven't seen for a long time, and you look, and because people change over time. I know I've said that about somebody I haven't seen for a long time, and people have even looked at me and said, "What happened to you?" You know, well, you know, kind of like the lady that went to the dentist, and she thought, "My, that guy looks so familiar. I really, you know, I know this guy from somewhere," and she finally figured it out. And she goes, "Well, where did you go to high school?" And sure enough, it was the same high school she went to. And she says, "Oh, I went there too." And she thought, boy, the old dentist is looking pretty decrepit. And the dentist says, "Huh, what did you teach?" So his impression of her was similar to her impression of him. So people change over time. It was a surprise. Ruth chapter 1, verse 20, she says, "Don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant. "Call me Mara," which means bitter, because the Lord has dealt very bitterly with me. She went out full, meaning had possessions and a family, and came home empty. So with Naomi meaning pleasant, and she called herself Mara, meaning bitter, she wasn't happy with what had happened in her life. And sometimes that happens. In life, we can come up with circumstances that cause us to be bitter. We think, you know, why did this have to happen to me? Why? I used to be pleasant. I used to have a happy situation. And now call me Mara. Call me bitter. In Ruth 1 and verse 22, we have Naomi and Ruth came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. So grain harvest. And that's what I was thinking about as I watched the combines sweeping through the field and dumping the grain this week into the trucks. We go to Ruth 2, chapter 2 and verse 1. There was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. Now, the word relative in other translations will be called kinsman redeemer. In other words, who can exercise the Levirate principle? So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean the heads of grain after him in whose sight I might find favor." Because Naomi says, well, that's a relative of her husband, meaning the dead man Elimelech. So he has a some obligation to look after us. Let us glean in the field. And so Ruth, verse 3, went and gleaned in the field. And then we read on in Leviticus 23, and I'm not going to turn there, but it's in verse 22, about when the Israelites were harvesting their land, they said, "You leave the corners, okay, for the stranger and the fatherless and the widow and so forth. For, in other words, you don't have to get every scrap. Let that be for the people who don't otherwise have the land to be able to harvest." And so what do you suppose Boaz did? If we read in Ruth chapter 2, and of course, we know that Ruth is out there gleaning in Boaz's field. In verse 5, Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" In other words, caught his eye. what's going on here? She's pretty young to be a widow, and yet she was. And so the servant who was in charge of the reapers says, well, it's that Moabite woman, because everybody knows everybody, remember, in all the neighborhoods, who came back from with Naomi from the country of Moab. So Boaz didn't forbid Ruth from gleaning, but he made arrangements for her safety by inviting her to continue to glean from his field. In verse 8, Ruth 2, verse 8, listen, my daughter, will you not? Do not go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women, meaning the other gals whom he was looking after or responsible for. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? In other words, leave you alone so you can be productive and gather what you need to for your mother-in-law. He says, when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn. In other words, he was making provision for Ruth. And in verse 10, Ruth says, what have I done to find favor in your eyes that you should notice me since I am a foreigner? Normally, foreigners were not welcome because they were a threat. And so accommodating a foreigner or stranger is dangerous business. Yet Boaz just didn't arbitrarily welcome anybody to glean on his property. Obviously, he did a background check on this woman. And what does it say in verse 11? And Boaz answered and said, now this is the background check. It has been fully reported to me all you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you left your father and mother in the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your week, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. He found the backstory and said, you're looking after your mother-in-law. That's pretty good. You know, that's a very godly approach. And so Ruth was appreciative of that in verse 13. In verse 14, Boaz invited Ruth for a meal. He says, come and eat the bread with him. And he passed food along to her. And she saved leftovers for her mother-in-law, Naomi. So if we continue on then in verse 15, Ruth rose up to glean. Boaz commanded his young men, let her glean among the sheaves. Don't just not around the edges and whatever's dropped. Just let her go in whole hog and have it, as it were. Probably a bad expression, whole hog, right? But in other words, just let her take whatever she will. And so when she went into the city and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gleaned, it was dramatic. It was a lot that she could go and harvest. Now, did they give it to her? No. She had to go work for it. She had to provide for herself and her mother-in-law. And Naomi said, blessed, in verse 20, be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. And Naomi said to her, the man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives. So you have this, this advice now coming in Ruth chapter 3, where Naomi is giving advice to Ruth and said, basically, she's explaining how you're going to capture this guy's heart. And verse 3, wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your best garment, but don't make yourself known until he's done eating and drinking. And then go uncover his feet and lie down, and he'll tell you what to do. It's going to scare the daylights out of him is what's going to happen. Shows up, and she said, okay, I'll do it. She followed her mother. Now, in Ruth 3, and she laid down on the threshing floor. The guy was sound asleep and woke up. In the middle of the night, it says, Ruth 3, verse 8, happened at midnight. The man was startled and turned himself there, and there's a woman lying on his feet, and said, who are you? Now, obviously, they didn't turn the light switch on. Who are you? And she said, I'm Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. Marrying the word kinsman redeemer. In other words, you have the right as a kinsman of my husband to be my new husband. Now, she's already, he already knows who she is. So then we read on in verse 10. What does Boaz say? Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, meaning female, as it were, household member. For you've shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, that you didn't go after the young men, whether poor or rich. In other words, she wasn't out terry hooting around. She was being responsible. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you what you request. All the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. Whoa. So people talk. They know who is being responsible and who is not. They have a, you know, they, now what if she weren't that way? What if it were the other way? What if she was bringing in, still worshiping the foreign gods, speaking ill of the tribe of Israel or of tribes of Judah, you know, disregarding God and the laws of God? But she wasn't. She was called virtuous. And so he said, well, stay there this tonight, and in the morning, he said, there's another relative closer nigh, verse 12. So, you know, not going to send her out in the middle of the night. It's all dark. So he said, and in the morning, he said, get up and leave before anybody can see you, because this is awkward and embarrassing. And it's appears to be, he said, there's somebody else that's ahead of me, that's ahead of, that has a right, a prior right of refusal or right of redemption. And so, and that explanation is, the right of redemption is really a property right. Who has the right to purchase a piece of property? And you can have what we call the right of first refusal in real estate. So if you're going to, if somebody else has the right to buy the property, you can give up that right for a price or give it away, whatever you wish, so somebody else can do that. My father had the right to buy a piece of property many years ago, and he decided that he would not exercise that right of first refusal. He turned it over to me. So I bought the property in his name. I exercised it. I was the, you know, I could do that and did that. That was a long time ago already. And, but it worked. And so here we have something similar. And he said, oh, somebody else has first right of refusal. And of course, and so Ruth goes home, and what does she tell Naomi? And she brings home all this grain that she has hauled. And Ruth 3 and verse 18, Naomi says, sit still, my daughter, and you will know the matter how it will turn out. For the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. And I had to sit down and laugh like crazy, because she obviously knew men. And that guy was obviously motivated. If the young lady was interested in him, he was interested in her. He was going to resolve the issues that day. You could see the hormones were running hot, that he was going to take care of it one way or another. And Ruth 4, verse 1, Boaz went to the gate, and the gate is where official decisions are made. And he sat down, and that's where the close relative that Boaz had spoken of had came by. So Boaz says, come aside, friend, meaning he's also a relative. Sit down, and he explained, and with 10 men, elders of the city. Now, this is where contracts are made at the gate. And he said, Naomi came back from Moab, sold the land before she left, meaning Elimelech. Well, what happens is, if you take a look at the way that the ancient Hebrew economic system was set up, when you sold land, you only sold it until the next Jubilee year, every 50 years. You only sold the number of crops for the value for the number of crops until the Jubilee year. So you're really buying or selling how many crops that there are left, and then it reverts back to the family that had it originally. So the land always stayed in the family. And so so what did Boaz tell the relative? He said, I thought to inform you, verse 4, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of the people. If you will redeem it, But if you don't, then and don't redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there's no one but you to redeem it, meaning first, and then I'm after you. And the guy says, sounds like a plan. I'll redeem it. I'll be the next, since Elimelech and his sons are dead. Now, this is, goes back to the right of first refusal. Now, and then Boaz says, oh, by the way, and let's look in Ruth 4 and verse 5. On the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the deceased, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. Whoa, so there's a glitch here somewhere. This isn't exactly a clean transaction, he's thinking. In verse 6, the close relative said, I can't redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You go ahead, redeem the right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Well, the unnamed man was worried that by marrying Ruth the Moabitess would upset his own lineage. His first son then would be legally the inheritor of Elimelech and Naomi. And so, now, why is that important? Because the firstborn son, according to the law of primogeniture, the firstborn gets a double portion. So however many there are, and we can read about that in Luke 15 and verse 11 and on about the double portion, but the eldest gets a double portion. And so if we read in Ruth 4 and verse 7 then, one man took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was a confirmation in Israel. So in verse 8, that was sealing the deal, the sandal, taking off your sandal. Now, and because in front of witnesses, now can you imagine somebody walking around with one shoe? The deal was made to the other one. Shoes don't come easy. I know as a teacher for many years, I'd always have students that forgot a pencil, needed a pen, and I would say, sure, I will lend you one. But of course, if I just lent them one, I would never see it again. So my standard, and everybody knew this, it didn't take long for the word to get around to the whole high school, that if you borrow a pencil from me, you must give me a shoe, one shoe. And when I get my pencil back, you get your shoe back. You're not leaving the room. Oh, how about you hold my cell phone, my wallet, anything? Nope, your shoe. I've never had a student leave the room. They will walk out without their cell phone. They will walk out without their wallet. They will walk out with anything else of value, but they will not walk out with one shoe. Never had a problem getting my pencil back. And I always kept a supply of pencils, and one student would say, oh man, I forgot. And the other one nudged student would say, just give up your shoe. And there were days when I would stack a whole row of shoes up on top of the whiteboard on the ledge, and everybody knew it. But that was the deal, and that sealed the deal. Where do you think I got the idea from? Right here, Ruth 4. And we get this idea when he calls her a younger woman, we get the impression that he's not, and he talks about younger men. So he apparently was older than her. And this sort of makes sense. If you look at who Boaz's father was, or mother was. Well, his father was Selma, but his mother was Rahab. She was a Canaanite woman. Well, in a world of arranged marriages, and you had an option, would you marry off your daughter to somebody who was the son of a Canaanite woman or son of another Israelite? So I can see some apprehension going on here. It's probably also why he was somewhat wealthy, because he wasn't spending money on other people. But so if we take a look here in Ruth 4, verse 13, Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and they went on to have a child. And verse 14, and the woman said to and the women, meaning of the area under Bethlehem, said, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative. May his name be famous in Israel." Because now legally and technically, although not biologically, Naomi has a grandson. This is huge, because and read on verse 15, that he may be to you a restorer of life, a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you, is better than seven sons has borne him. Then Naomi took the child, laid on her bosom, and became a nurse to him. And the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi. And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. So this genealogy was critical here, but Naomi had somebody that she could dote on, as well as Ruth. They had somebody to look after them as society expected, indeed. So what are the lessons that we normally listen to from the book of Ruth? What are we supposed to bring from all this? First of all, God calls whom he will into the knowledge of the truth. In John 6:44, no one comes to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. Now, Orpah had the same opportunity. She went back. Ruth went forward. Secondly, we are to welcome those who respond to God's calling. In John 13, verses 34 and 35, where Jesus said, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. And by this, you will know that you are my disciples, if what? If you have love one for another. So when somebody comes in, they're new, we're to love them, even if they don't have the same background. Third point is, in Romans 14, 13, we don't need to be a stumbling block to those who are responding to God's calling. In Romans 14, verse 13, let us not condemn one another, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. If they are coming into our family of the truth, then let's not make it hard for them. Let's make it easier for them. Point four, we're not only to recognize those whom God are responding to God's call, but to love and care for them, and of not just avoiding putting a stumbling block, but we're to actively participate in being helpers of their joy. We read 2 Corinthians 1, verse 24, and 2 Corinthians 1, 24. Not that we have dominion over your faith, but are fellow workers for your joy, for by faith you stand. Isn't that a wonderful thought, that we can all be fellow workers for each other's joy? We can be full participants to helping others. So let's take a look and summarize the life of Naomi. And you know, in some ways, I'll try to correlate it to our lives. And from all appearances, Naomi, in her life, always tried to do the right thing. But tragedy continued to strike her. First of all, she married within the faith, in the tribe of Judah, had two sons, but a famine arose. They were hungry. Secondly, she followed her husband, even though he took her to a foreign land. She was faithful to her husband, dedicated to her children. Third, her sons married outside the faith, outside the tribes of Israel, in that foreign land. But even so, point four, Naomi did her best to have a good relationship with her daughters-in-law, and they both clearly loved her. They respected her. They wanted to be with her. And one of those clung to Naomi so much, that would be Ruth, moved to a distant land with her. And how many mothers-in-law have that especially close relationship with their daughters-in-law? When Naomi was widowed and left bereft also by the death of her sons, there was no one left to care for Naomi in Moab. She decided to go back to Bethlehem. And point six of her life on the lifeline, Naomi actively guided her daughter-in-law Ruth in the ways of the nation of Israel. She taught her about God. She taught her about the customs and what the expectations were. And it was through then, point seven, Naomi's husband's kinsman, Boaz, Naomi was able to have a legal son to claim her husband's inheritance and care for Naomi and Ruth in their old age. You see, Naomi suffered from a famine, and God used the perseverance of Naomi to bring Ruth into the fellowship of Israel. God used the good example of Naomi to show it was possible for Ruth to become converted to the true God. And God preserved the story of Ruth and Naomi in that book of the Bible as an example for all time. In fact, the story is so important that the physical lineage of Christ was recorded as coming through the union of Boaz and Ruth. That marriage was made possible then by God and facilitated by the love and diligence of Naomi. So now let's ask our questions. Are we following in the footsteps of Naomi? Each one of us can ask, we've spent years and years doing what we know to be right. We go to church, we keep the Sabbath, we keep the annual holy days, we pray, we fast from time to time, we tithe, we follow God's dietary laws. We do our best to show love to our families and our brethren and our church and our neighbors and being good stewards of the blessings that God has given us. And like Naomi, we did what we were supposed to do, even if we do it imperfectly. But not everything always turns out well. Did we start out being pleasant, which is the definition, or that's the word explaining Naomi, and later become bitter, which Naomi called herself Mara, when hard times came upon us? So if we ask ourselves then, are we doing everything God expects of us? Are we living patient and godly lives in such a manner that others who may be strangers to God are so taken by our example that when they want to leave, that they want to leave their gods and seek the true God? Look at the qualities that Naomi demonstrated, that we might be like her in her influence upon others. And the example of Naomi causes us to consider how to be prepared to welcome the future Ruths into our lives, that we can be prepared to bring those who were once strangers, to welcome them into our congregation, to make them part of our families, to love them as God has loved us and brought us into his family. Without a loving and caring Naomi, it's hard to imagine that there would have been the Book of Ruth. So for our benefit and the benefit of the work of the living God, let us do our part to be the best type of Naomi that we can be.